Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of the Jam Base Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein, and co-hosting with me today is David Onigman. As usual, we'll begin the episode with a rundown of news stories from the past few weeks, and then Davo will host a Reelin' in the Year segment featuring guitarist Ross James of the Terrapin Family Band and his assorted other projects. And finally, Jam Base contributor Chad Bernstein provides an oral companion to this month's The Art of the Sit-In column. Chad chats with Aqueous guitarist Mike Ganser about all the work he puts into guest appearances, and Mike shares a great story and more. But unfortunately, not all of the news in the rundown is of the good variety. Dave, can you fill us in on Ray Pachkowski's situation?
Yeah, Trey Anastasio shared a note this week that read as follows. Hi friends, after a few months of experiencing headaches and nausea, Ray ended up in the emergency room not long ago. It was discovered that he had a brain tumor. He went into surgery on Friday and is expected to make a full recovery. His family is with him, and I was able to visit with him last week. He was in good spirits despite the situation. We are all hoping, praying, and sending him mountains of love and best wishes. We love you, Ray. Get well soon. Hashtag love for the milkman. So yeah, we all here at Jam Base are sending our love to the milkman as well. He is such a great guy and an incredibly talented keyboard player. Watching his left hand and the crazy shit he does with it is some of my favorite parts of watching Trey's various bands over all these years. Trey's band is heading out for a run of shows at the end of April, beginning of May. Can't imagine Ray is going to be out there for those shows, and that's going to be some of the only solo band Trey shows without Ray in quite some time. Trey's band went through a bit of a revolving door of a rotating cast between the years of 2005 and 2006, but the one constant for all those bands was Ray. Going back all the way to the summer of 2001, he's been in like anything Trey has done. Classic Tab wasn't a throwback to the 99 trio, it was the 99 trio and Ray. Ray even accompanied Trey to those Dave Matthews and Friends shows. So no indication has been made if Trey is going to go out without keys for the first time in basically 17 years, or if they'll find someone to fill his chair for the tour. Big shoes to fill. The important part, though, is we all hope Ray gets better very soon, and happy to see the phrase expected to make a full recovery in there.
Quick update. In between the time we recorded the rundown and when we were publishing the podcast, Trey Anastasio announced he will indeed go forward with his spring tour. Trey will be joined by drummer Russ Lawton and bassist Tony Markellis for a run of dates as the Trey Anastasio Trio. As Dave alluded to, these will be the first trio show since Anastasio's 1999 solo tour. Trey kicks off the run on April 17th, which happens to be the 20th anniversary of the 8-foot fluorescent tube show at the original Higher Ground. That night was the first time Trey took the stage with Russ and Tony, and a statement on Trey.com says, "While Ray rests up, we have decided to use this upcoming short tour to celebrate this milestone and play the entire run as a trio for the first time since 1999. We will keep Ray in our hearts and minds as he recovers over the next few months and look forward to the full Tab lineup returning to the road soon."
But looking ahead to the summer, Scotty, there was an exciting tour announced with Mule and the Avits. Can you tell us about it?
Absolutely. And, you know, when the Peach Music Festival, which takes place in Scranton each summer, announced its lineup for this year, one of the more intriguing listings was Dark Side of the Mule. And the theme dates back to Government Mule's 2008 Muleween show at the Orpheum in Boston, and they covered a bunch of Pink Floyd songs, some deeper cuts, but a lot of more greatest hit stuff with saxophonist Ron Holloway and some backing vocalists. And then Mule released that set, or highlights from the set, as Dark Side of the Mule as an album late in 2014, and then reprised the tribute at the 2015 Mountain Jam Festival. We'll be right back. So I thought that was going to be it. I thought Peach Festival would get a Dark Side of the Mule set. But we recently learned that not only will Mule present Dark Side of the Mule at Peach Fest, they're taking it on the road for a series of six co-headlining dates with the Avid Brothers. As the icing on the cake, Rich Robinson and the Magpie Salute are going to open each night. So we're talking a set from the Magpie Salute, followed by a set from the Avids, and then a Government Mule performance that the press release said is going to morph into Dark Side of the Mule. Not too shabby. And the press release also mentions they're going to be joined by several special guest musicians, Mule that is. So I'd imagine we'll see at least a horn player, maybe some backing vocalists, but we'll see. And the first, there's two runs of 3 dates, and the first run will take place in July, and it starts on at Jones Beach, just outside of New York City, on July 12th. And then the three bands head to Jersey for a performance at the Garden State Arts Center near where I grew up in Homedale, New Jersey, on July 13th. And then they come to the Boston area venue that's formerly known as Great Woods and now is the Xfinity
Center. Still known as Great Woods.
On July 14th. And then they get back at it, the three bands, Mule, Avits, Magpie Salute, in the Midwest in late August. And they'll bring the tour to Noblesville, Indiana on August 23rd, Tinley Park, Illinois on the 24th, and then Clarkston, Michigan on the 25th. And, you know, we're speaking of the Peach Festival and that Mule set that's going down. Dave, can you provide an update on some of the festival lineups that have come out recently?
I can. Festival lineup news never stops. It's like the U.S. mail. The inaugural Grand Doozy Festival will take place at Overland Golf Course in Denver between September 14th and 16th. Organizers Superfly, that's the co-creators of Bonnaroo and Outside Lands, have unveiled this year's lineup. Kendrick Lamar will headline the action on Friday night, while Florence and the Machine headline on Saturday, and Stevie Wonder headlines on Sunday. Sturgill Simpson, Phoenix, St. Vincent, The War on Drugs, Mavis Staples, and Carl Denson's Tiny Universe are among the other acts confirmed for Grand Doozy. The Peach Festival made a number of impressive ads. That's happening in Scranton, as Scotty mentioned. While Mo was already aboard for two sets, organizers revealed one of them will find the veteran Jam Act teaming with Little Feat and the Turquoise Horns for performance of Little Feat's iconic live album, Waiting for Columbus. The Revivalists, O'Teal and Friends, Michael Franti and Spearhead, Carl Denson's Tiny Universe, ZZ Ward, Band of Changes, Third World, and The Suffers are among the additions announced. And our good friends at the High Sierra Music Festival also rolled out a number of additions to their lineup. Joining the party in Quincy, California are new additions Grace Potter, Chris Robinson Brotherhood, Foundations of Funk, The Floozies, Margot Price, The Motet, Ernest Ranglin, Billy Strings, and many more. We will see you there. And Scotty is going to get us caught up now on Widespread Panic's recent shows and recent announcements.
Yeah, Panic returned to the stage this past weekend for a series of 3 shows just outside of Washington, D.C. at the recently opened the Theater at National Harbor in Oxnell, Maryland. And as Panic fans know, the band has cut back on touring in recent years, and the 3 nights in the D.C. area were their first shows in over a month. And I listened to all 3, and I gotta say, I was impressed. You know, Panic did a really nice job of mixing staples with rarities and choice covers all weekend long. And John Bell and the guy seemed to be sending a message on the first night by playing songs that seemed to have a semi-political tint with Hope in a Hopeless World, The Shape I'm In, and Jaded Tourist. But the big news from the first night, which took place on the Thursday, was the return of Come Together. And Widespread had only covered the Beatles classic a handful of times during the George McConnell era in 2005 and went 819 shows between plays leading up to that March 15th show.
Yeah.
They also dusted off Traveling Man for the first time since 2014. And Friday Night, you know, really featured a true career-spanning set list that, it's, as it seemed, they pulled from every era of their career. I really like the Slipping Into Darkness cover that they did that opened the second set, and I love the way they fit disco into Driving Song. And Night 2 of the Run also featured a cover debut as John Bell led the band through Love in Vain, a song that I know best from the Stones recording it for Let It Bleed, but was originally penned by Robert Johnson. And Widespread Panic's run in the D.C. area concluded on St. Patrick's Day, and fittingly, the six-piece worked in a number of songs that discussed drinking, whether it was Tall Boy or Busted Big, Protein Drink, Blackout Blues, and Fish Water. And they also opened up Sundown Betty, which is their newest song, newest original. They debuted it earlier this year in Mexico, and it was a minute or two longer than the original, so it's nice to see they're giving that some improvisational love. And speaking of improvisation, you know, my jam highlight of that final show was a run of Ride Me High into Blackout Blues, and that was part of the last set of the run. But really, the whole second set was a scorcher, as they ended with a Red Hot Mama sandwich on Fish Water Bread. And you got to give the band credit for celebrating St. Patty's Day with yet another cover debut as part of their three-song encore. JB sang the Panic debut of Tura Lura Lura, an Irish-American song that dates back to the early 20th century. And I have a feeling most of our listeners, myself included, best know it as one of the songs Van Morrison sang with the band at the last waltz. And overall, it's just a killer run for Panic, who continue to show that they don't need to be on the road all the time to present great runs. And in other Panic news, the band continues a tradition this June when they'll play their annual three-night stand at Red Rocks in Colorado. This year's run is set for June 22nd through the 24th, and this is a tradition of three-night stands that dates back to 1999. Since that time, they've only missed 3 years, and they also have quite a sellout streak going of 50-plus shows. And so it's an exciting time for Panic. Dave, there's a new feature for the podcast and for the rundown. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, podcast listeners, we are looking to hear from you. We are going to try out our first round of the Jam Bass Podcast Mailbag. You ask questions, we answer. They could be questions about the bands in the Jam Bass universe in general, the live music business, the operations here at Jam Bass or the podcast, webcasts, festival lineups, the meaning of life, if Trey teased Dave's energy guide at a show with a tape that doesn't circulate, did it still make a sound? You name it. You can send all of your questions over to podcast@jambase.com. Again, that is podcast@jambase.com. Your complaints can go to Scott Bernstein at... No, I'm just joking. And we will answer some or all of these on our episode in a couple of weeks. And that's it, this week's rundown. Up next, I chat with Ross James from the Terrapin Family Band and Cosmic Twang and Terrapin Crossroads for our Reelin' in the Years segment. Hope you enjoy it. All right, welcome to Reelin' in the Years here on the Jam Bass Podcast. I've got Ross James here at the Jam Bass headquarters in San Francisco. Ross, how's it going?
Good, man. Good to be here.
Stay up on that mic, Ross.
Oh, yes. All right, there thanks. There we go.
All right, so you sort of came onto sort of the Jam Bass universe radar right around when Terrapin Crossroads opened up. Yeah. And when Brian Lesh was playing in a band called American Jubilee. But why don't you take us back to the bands you were in before you started playing with Brian?
Yeah, well, I mean, I moved out to California like 10 years ago or so, and I was living in Sacramento, and the main gig I had there, I had two sort of country bands I was playing in. One was called the Bathtub Gins, and another called the Dry Creek Rounders.
Time out, your first band was named after a fish song?
Absolutely not. Oh. I can assure you.
You just named it Bathtub
Gins. I didn't name it. It was a bunch of old dudes. Believe me.
It just somehow happened.
Believe me. I would never play in a band named after a fish song. I can assure you of that.
Sorry. Bathtub Gins and...
The Dry Creek Rounders. Yeah. And yeah, one of them was, the bathtub gins was like a bunch of like 50-year-old dudes, and we played classic country tunes all over Sacramento. And then the other band was sort of like a kind of a bluegrassy thing. I lived up in Auburn, and some friends of mine up there, original tunes mainly, and yeah, just playing around the Sacramento area. And I was always looking for gigs and selling guitars, buying guitars on Craigslist and stuff. And there was an ad looking for a guitar and steel player down here in the Bay Area. And all it said was guitar, pedal steel, 18 to 24, who likes Larry Campbell and Dave Rawlings.
Sounds so, like a personal ad.
not quite. Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was kind of written for me or whatever, and I responded, didn't say anything about who it was or whatever, and I show up to audition for this gig, and it's in Ross in Marin County, and I'd never been to Marin County ever before. I didn't even know what it was like, and go to this house, and there's a big gate and all this stuff, and I mean, I didn't come from that kind of scene, so it was a bit of a shock to me. And we go downstairs, and there's a grand piano in the basement, and this dude's playing this crazy bass that I'd never seen before, and it was Phil's Doug Irwin bass.
Oh, okay.
And with the crisscross pickups, and I'm like, where am I right now? What the hell is going on? And
was it Phil playing the bass?
No, it was Scott Harvey, who was the bass player in American Jubilee.
Yeah.
And so I'd learned like four of their tunes, and we played them. It went well, and they said they'd get back to me on Monday or whatever. It was like Thursday, I think. And they had a gig that weekend, which turned out to be the last Further Festival.
Ah, okay.
And they called me Monday, and I had the gig and played with Brian for a few years in that band. I'm on a head back out west.
It's time I get back out west. And
and the Terrapin opened.
Yes, the timeline is foggy in my head. That band was established before they opened Terrapin Crossroads.
Yeah, when I started playing with them, they were called Blue Light River. And it was, I mean, that they were probably a band like 5 years before Terrapin.
Okay.
I joined a couple years into that.
Gotcha.
I think it was about 3 years before Terrapin opened.
All right, so you're playing in American Jubilee. You guys are playing around the Bay Area, and that's your main band
those days? Yeah, that was the main thing.
Okay, and then Terrapin opens up. And you guys start playing a lot more there. And talk to us about the various hats you started to wear at Terrapin when it opened up.
So I guess it was like
2012?
Yeah, Terrapin so opened? Christmas 2011, we were at a Christmas party that was Brian's fiance's family's Christmas party. And I was having some champagne, feeling good. And talking to Phil about the Velvet Underground, because that's like my favorite band of all time, and how the Velvet Underground and the Dead were both called the Warlocks before they had to change their name, just talking about them. And he's like talking about how he hates the Velvet Underground.
Oh no.
I know, and it was like, I was getting a little aggravated, you know? Like, tell you everything's made out of dirt. You know women never really faint, and villains always blink their eyes, and children are the only ones that blush, and life is just a lie. Anyone who getting a little heated, upset. And
I've had a little to drink.
And I've had a little to drink, and I'm just like, I got to get out of this conversation. And I remember ending it with something like, I hear what you guys are doing down at starting this Terrapin thing up, and if you ever need help, like, running cable or anything like that, because I was doing live sound. That's what I've done since I was, like, 17 for a job. And just wanted to be a part of what they were building. It sounded really cool. And then a week later or so, they emailed me and offered me, like, a production assistant job, basically, at Terrapin. So the month before Terrapin opened in March of 2012. That February, Phil did all these rehearsals with, like, Jackie and Warren and Sco and Russo, I think, and Comenti for some shows that they were doing somewhere else. And I was like mixing monitors for that and running and getting coffee, like just whatever needed to happen, basically. It's a pretty bare bones crew that they were using at that point. So it was cool to be around it. I'd never been around this music before and never really heard any of these guys play. It was,
so all those years playing with American Jubilee, you still sort of hadn't picked up the music of the Dead.
So no, I mean, I sort of shied away from it. I wasn't really into it ever. I mean, Phil played with Jubilee and we did like Franklin's Tower and Rider.
Pretty simple tunes.
Yeah,
that
was about as much as I'd gotten into it, I guess. Yeah.
Okay, so you're a PA at Terrapin, but when I first met you, which was a few years ago now, you were basically running the great room at Terrapin.
Yeah.
So what changed in between when you were sort of being a PA and when you were kind of running that place?
So, I mean, I guess it's sort of like right place, right time, and me being eager to do whatever needed to get done. I mean, whether it was playing or doing some behind-the-scenes work or booking shows or whatever, I was just around when these discussions were happening. Like the first shows at Terrapin, those soft opening shows where we played in the bar with like the Railroad Earth guys and Weir and Jackie and Nikki and all those people, I was doing sound and playing, and I'd never played these tunes before. Like at the same time, I'm running monitors and front of house and playing guitar.
A wise man once told me. I think it was you.
I don't know about that.
No?
Maybe.
A little bit of it.
Yeah, but that's part of what makes it magic.
Yes.
I mean,
now it was when we recorded that alligator video with you, and you kept bringing in additional musicians.
Oh,
that
you
didn't tell us about.
Yeah,
It's like, oh yeah, and Metzger's gonna play guitar. I didn't know they were gonna be. Bass.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh cool. You didn't tell us any of this, and we have 8 tracks, and you were like, what'd you expect? That's terrible. Yeah, it's gonna be a little bit of a show.
It all works out. Yeah, little baptism by fire thing in the beginning for sure. Yeah. And I mean, it was so loose back then, like. Phil would call me in the afternoon and be like, hey, do you want to play a bar show with me and Jackie tonight? You know, like that's how things were coming together before we really figured out what Terrapin was even, you know? And as it went on, I was there and like maybe a sound guy got sick or something and somebody needed to step in. So I would step in and then I could do that. They knew that I could do that moving forward. And in the beginning, Phil's old tour manager was sort of the house manager, just the way it worked out. You know, that was the person that they had working with them. And then he moved on. And when he moved on, I started taking over some of his stuff and eventually ended up taking over the tour manager role for a couple of years, too. But when we first started the bar music program, it was kind of Brian and I that spearheaded that. Booking shows, like, I mean, in the beginning we didn't have music every day, and that was kind of our idea to make it happen. So we'd reach out to different people, our friends or people that we dug and wanted to have them play at Terrapin. And I mean, it's such a cool place that you can just call up anybody and be like, hey, do you want to come do this gig? And pretty much everybody's into the idea. So yeah, I guess that's kind of how it started.
What was it like those couple years being Phil's TM? Like, you were sort of his guy even during the Fare Thee Well shows.
Yeah.
What was sort of...
It was pretty wild.
The enormity of that, like, and what did that entail for you?
Totally surreal, man. I mean, it was my first tour managing gig. I mean, I've been around this since, high school and stuff.
Baptism by fire.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, the first tour managing gig was on the birthday runs at the Cap. Maybe the year before Fare Thee Well, and then I did it for a year, and then the Fare Thee Well thing happened. But I mean, that was unlike, I'd never even been to a stadium show before those, you know? And seeing all that went into it was incredibly eye-opening, and just how that production team handled their business was really, really cool to see. Just pro at the top level all the way around. And, I mean, the rehearsals, everything going into it. I mean, there were, like, some vocal rehearsals at TRI that was just Phil, Bob, Trey, Hornsby, and me. Like, those were the only people in the room. And I remember sitting there like, how in the hell did I get in this situation? Super strange, you know? But
those must have been the rehearsals. Trey talks about it in an interview where they never got around to rehearsing Addicts. Have you seen his quotes about that?
I haven't seen that, but I'm sure they didn't get around to it.
It was going to be the big finale in Chicago, and they kept saying they were going to rehearse it, and they never did. And
that sounds right.
Trey hired someone to
chart out all the parts.
Chart parts for him and Bruce, such that no matter what the other vocalist right. did, it would still sound okay.
Right.
And according to him, they like never actually rehearsed it before. Yeah,
I believe it.
Playing it.
As I believe it for sure.
Encore there.
I mean, it was weird. Something at that level, it's a totally different kind of thing. It's less personal, for sure. And I mean, I don't know. It's not like playing, you know, in a theater or in a bar or in a club or right. anything. It's just like, it's kind of got a mind of its own, and there's so many people involved in it that, I don't know. It loses something for me.
Gotcha. So somewhere we're probably going to have to jump around here because we couldn't really figure out before we started recording the exact order that these things happen. But yeah. somewhere along here, you also start a band with Scott Law, Cosmic Twang, and you also sort of get thrown in the formalized house band,
right.
or not even house band, now it's sort of a touring band as well, the Terrapin Family Band.
Yep.
So if we start, we'll start with Cosmic Twang and then and talk about the family band too.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometime right when American Jubilee was sort of fizzling out, Scott Law magically appeared at Terrapin. I don't even know where he came from or who brought him in. I think maybe Tim Bloom, maybe it was like a broke down gig or something like that. Mm-hmm. But him and I hit it off right away. And I mean, he's like my favorite person in the world to make music with. And we just kept playing together. It all happened really organically. And this thing sort of grew out of it called Cosmic Twang. And it's basically him and I and a rotating cast of freaks that are crazy enough to sign up to play with us.
Rotating cast of what you call the band, too. Here at Jam Base, we like really need to normalize our data when we put it in the database. You and all of the Terrapin guys are really just like...
Yeah.
Such repeat offenders, is it Ross James and Scott Law's Cosmic Twang?
Yeah.
Is it Scott Law and Ross James? Is it just Cosmic Twang? Can you clear this up
you
for
call
us
it,
now?
You call it whatever so you want. We're bad at the branding.
All right, we're just going to merge all these profiles.
merge it all.
Do. Yeah. And, like, you have some fucking band name with kittens.
You're
in
the Broken
it too,
Kittens. Yeah, and that came out
Radio
of Alan Forbes'
Galaxy
brain. That's long gone.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the band name thing doesn't matter.
No, it's like Terrapin just breeds these perpetual questions at Jam Base where we have to slack each other. Like, is this a band?
Right.
Or
is this going to stick?
Should we just just put the musicians on there until they play five shows we'll say this is a...
Yeah.
But Cosmic Twang is one that has definitely stuck around.
Yeah, it's sticking.
And that's sort of your main gig these days, right?
Yeah, we're having a lot of fun with it. And it's a blend of some of my tunes, some of Scott's tunes, some tunes that we've written together, and then covers from all over the map that we like playing, you know, basically. And we brought in a diverse group of people over the last couple of years to play with us. Like, I mean, Holly Bowling, Dave Schools, Cass McCombs, and then all the Terrapin regulars too. So it's been a lot of fun.
Cool. And talk about the formation of the family band. We had Graham on the podcast.
Yeah.
And he said it sort of came out of a sort of desire to have like a core band, so it wasn't like always like, oh, you're playing with John Scofield and he you know has his versions of the tune, now you're playing
totally.
With
yeah,
Jimmy
yeah.
and Warren and they have their versions of the tunes. Was the formation of that band when you really needed to start learning the entire catalog? That already in the mix through all the bar gigs and everything?
That was already in the mix, and I'd done Phil and Friends stuff, you know, before the family band was sort of the main thing. But it allowed us to dig deeper into it. And I mean, to be able to rehearse without like a fire underneath you, because you got a gig in a couple hours, you know what I mean? And that's how it is a lot of the time, because we just never stop. You know, there's always a gig and there's always a new set list. And it's not like you get the set list, you know, even a day before the gig most of the time. We make it up. Sometimes we'll get together and we'll come up with a list right there. And then we're like, all right, what do we need to go over? But with the family band, it sort of allowed us to take a week where there's no gigs and rehearse three times in that week. And just sort of like work on stuff, explore different like musical areas that we wanted to get to. And it what came with that is a level of comfort that isn't there with a lot of Phil and Friends lineups. Which is, I mean, sometimes that lack of comfort ends up just coming off as excitement and turns into magic, too. It's not necessarily always a bad thing.
Sure, yeah.
But I think Phil digs it because he hasn't really, like, had that kind of thing since the Q.
Right.
Had, like, a stable band where you feel that sort of camaraderie, that brotherhood, that comfort that goes along with it. So it's been pretty cool and exciting for everybody, and I know Phil especially.
Did you ever go back and listen to that stuff from the Q and sort of like your sort of late education in the music?
I've listened to some of it.
They played Terrapin a little bit as well.
I mean, I'm kind of, I know Graham listens back to a lot of stuff, and he can like, he knows really good versions or versions that he really digs from certain shows and that kind of thing. That's not really my style with this. I don't know. I learn the tunes. A lot of the times I'll learn the tunes off the record, because that's the one time you can hear everybody playing the correct thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then the show's going to be what it's going to be. Even if you rehearse it one way, it's not going to be that way when you play it. So I'm really in the moment with all the stuff and just try to have a good framework of the tune every time we go for it.
Yep. And you are now back to or at being a full-time musician.
Yes.
You're sort of your day-to-day at Terrapin is in your past.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
put
yeah.
in your years yeah. and and everything there and got towards it. Can you talk a little bit about the decision to just go for it?
Yeah.
And just play full-time?
I mean, it was definitely making it so like I didn't really want to play as much. You know, like it was hard to go from working all day, being on the phone, answering emails, booking hotels and all that stuff. And
Jam then just, Bass is always there trying to record videos.
Exactly.
For
yeah. yeah. Answering your emails. And... Yeah. Yeah. And then flip a switch and go play guitar. Like that wasn't really working for me.
Yeah.
And I wasn't able to practice the way I wanted to practice, and I wasn't writing. And I don't know. It's like, it was great experience. And I mean, totally life changing, but I was ready to move on a little bit.
Sure. And but you're still playing there all the time.
Yeah, all the time. And it's a great home base for sure. Yeah. And I'm really lucky to be involved in it the way that I am. And
you just put out a record.
I did.
Solo record.
Yeah, which I'm really stoked about. We recorded it out at a Panoramic House in Stinson Beach. And I mean, I basically booked 3 days there just to invite all my friends out and have a party and roll tape, and had no idea about what we were going to do. And it ended up being pretty magical. And we cut half the record in those 3 days. And, yeah, I mean, it just all came together. You better leave that poison alone. Scott's on it a bunch, all the Terrapin dudes, Tim and Nikki Bloom, Phil plays on a couple tracks, and yeah, it's all original tunes. Betty Cantor Jackson mastered it.
Nice.
Yeah, and then her and I went down to Golden Sound in Ventura and mastered it for vinyl, cut it to cut the masters right there, and then it was pressed in California, so I really went for it. I mean, it's what I've wanted since I was 12 years old, basically. So,
awesome.
Yeah, I'm stoked on it.
And what's 2018 got in store for you? I know you guys sort of have a little mini residency going on, excuse me, at the Chapel in San Francisco.
Yep.
What's your touring itinerary going to look like? Since yeah. That's sort of your main thing.
Yeah, so I mean, when I'm home, we're doing the Chapel every other month, basically, and then Terrapin all the time. Then we've got a bunch of festival dates with Phil.
Right.
This summer, and we're doing Red Rocks in May, which will be pretty cool. I've never even been there, so.
Whoa, all right.
I know, I'm excited about that one. And then with Cosmic Twang, we're doing some festivals. We're doing the Hypnic down in Big Sur, and then the Chris Robinson Brotherhood's Festival down at the same place in Big Sur in September. So, yeah, a lot of festivals this season.
Cool. Where can our listeners keep up with you other than Jambase? Where can they follow you? What's your website, et cetera?
RossJamesMusic.com.
Okay.
And, yeah, that and the Facebook
page.
Ross James.
You're a pretty good Instagrammer.
Oh, yeah. Tex Bacon.
As well. Tex Bacon. Yeah. What's that all about?
Back in those Bathtub Gins days.
When you were in the Fish Cover Band?
Yeah, okay, you got to watch it. If you only knew how far from the truth that was, Holly Bolin could tell you. Yeah. I had two nicknames, basically. One was Tex. I wore a cowboy hat all the time. And then the other one was Bacon. So just combined them.
All right.
And there it is.
Cool. Thanks so much, Ross.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
Cheers.
This is Chad Bernson with Jambase, and I'm here talking with Mike Ganser from Aqueous. Mike, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you too, man.
Welcome to the Jambase podcast. If you've had a chance to check it out, our latest The Art of the Sit-In feature up on Jambase features just a super interview with Mike and talking all about what a phenomenal year Aqueous has come off of and lots of big things coming for the rest of this year. And, you know, Mike, for kind of the purposes of this interview, I mean, we couldn't help but notice, in addition to, you know, certainly all of the interesting things you're doing within the band with Aqueous, you're a ubiquitous presence out there sitting in with other bands. It was great to see you, you know, certainly with Mo a couple of weeks ago out there in Albany, and over the past year with so many of our scene's favorite bands. And as I understand it, and you talk about this in your chat with us, you have kind of a scientific approach to sitting in. How do you apply yourself when you're in these types of situations?
Yeah, man. I think a lot of it just kind of comes from a place of wanting to respect the music of the band that I'm contributing to first, you know? So, like, it's kind of about, you know, going up there and making a statement, you know, and being featured like you're supposed to, but, you know, it's just kind of the point of the sit-in. But also, like, trying to add and contribute to the band and not just play over everything and to find a way to make it a bit more musical and, like, really respect their music first, you know? And so a lot of how I go about that is to try to, like, initially lock in with the rhythm section and listen to every member of the band and try to engage every member of the band and make people smile and kind of have fun with it. But like lay out when you're, you know, I like to lay out when I'm supposed to and like to like give it some space and not overdo it. And so, you know, there's a couple different aspects of, you know, I mean, it kind of comes down to what situation you find yourself in terms of a sit-in, you know, because, on one hand, sometimes you get ton of prep time. You know, the band will give you, you know, the tune that you're playing way ahead of time, and you can sit and do your homework. And for me, I like to like really, really do my homework when they, you know, when a band gives me that time, because I think it's really fun, and it's like it's such an honor when a band asks you to join them. And I like to try to respect that as much as I can by like really knowing the tune. And sometimes even like if I feel so bold, like I like to add little parts, you know, or make harmonies. If it's, you know, just one guitar player, so maybe I'll add another guitar part that wasn't there just for fun. And, you know, versus a situation where, you know, 5 minutes before the band that you're going to sit in with is going to go on, and they walk past you and say, hey, do you want to sit in tonight? And they tell you this song is in this key, just, you know, you'll follow me for the changes. And then it's kind of more about sitting back and listening and trying to like be as on your toes as you can. And so, you know, yeah, it's just kind of goes scenario to scenario, but, you know, that's kind of my general approach.
As you noted, you definitely do prefer when you can do some homework. And I think you told me, you know, you've surprised bands and some of your sit-in hosts once in a while with how well you know the tune.
Yeah, I just think that's fun, man. I like seeing the surprise on their faces. And I think a lot of, you know, the point of music is to connect and communicate with your fellow musicians. And I feel like that, you know, that does communicate the respect to it is important to me, you know, like to show them, like, listen, I care about your tune. I think this, you know, I think you're a great band. Like, I think it's just kind of, it's something I really like to do. And I remember I did that with a whole talk song a few years ago. It was one of their songs called Tumblr, which is like one of my favorite ones. And I just like rewrote a bunch of parts for it because, you know, like I was saying in the interview, I came from a place of doing a lot of dual guitar work with my guitar player Dave over in Aqueous, and Top just has the one singular guitar, and then, you know, Matt on guitar, and then AC on keys. And so there was all kinds of opportunities to add these little parts. And I just kept seeing them like be super surprised and almost like freaked out, like, wow, what the heck. But, you know, that was like a lot of these bands I sit in with, I really do love their music. And so it's not like, you know, like I already knew the song because I listened to it before. I like to listen to a lot of the bands and I see them. You know, it's just, for me, that's like a fun thing. It probably sounds crazy to somebody else. Like, why would you want to do work? You know, like, but for me, like that's where that kind of work is like way fun. It's probably like just the nerdiest thing to say, but I really dig it.
Well, for the audiences and the band members too, it's a lot more interesting than just sort of waiting around to be pointed at to solo. So definitely give you a lot of credit for the work put in, Mike. So we're wondering, I mean, in the written interview, you talk about sitting in with Mo, a band you grew up with on Waiting for the Punchline in Albany earlier this year in 2018. I understand that, you know, of course, along the already rich history that Aqueous shares with Mo, you guys had a pretty interesting sit-in story that came from a night in Boston from not all that long ago. And I would love for you to share that one, if you don't mind.
Yeah, that was an interesting one because, you know, Aqueous was in town and, you know, in Boston doing a show with our friend Dopapot over at a club, you know, across town at the Paradise. And so we, you know, we played our set and it went great and it was super fun. And, you know, we heard, you know, we knew that Mo was in town just, you know, maybe about 15 minutes away. And we thought, you know, maybe we'll go, you know, go see, you know, see those guys and say hello. So, you know, we did. And it was arranged for us to be able to just, you know, come and chill. And so, you know, we got there in between one of their sets and we're just, you know, catching up and, you know, saying hi to the guys and, you know, Al, you know, talking to Al and Chuck and, you know, Al is like, you know what might be really funny? You guys are all here. It's like, what if we sent you guys out for the encore? And we're all like, what? Like, what? That's crazy, you know, because at that point we hadn't sat in with Mo at all and we were just kind of like getting to know them and maybe still slightly, you know, and I don't want to say intimidated, but, you know, like they were like a big deal to us growing up and we were just kind of like super psyched to, you know, be backstage with them and hanging and stuff. And so, yeah, Al's like, you know, why don't you guys go out there for our encore instead of us? And I was like, well, that sounds amazing. I was like, but we don't have any of our gear. And he's like, oh, he's like, that's fine, man. Just use all of ours. Like, you can use, you know, you play a Strat, right? Like use Chuck's Strat and you know, Dave can use my guitar and you know, just you guys can go right up. And I was like, wow, pretty nuts, like, sure. And so, you know, lo and behold, like, they, you know, they finished, they had a whole nother set to do. And so we kind of all sat side stage and watched. And I think all of us were a little nervous, like, you know, just we didn't really know exactly what to do. And so it ended up being a scenario where, yeah, they sent us out and everybody was like super surprised and probably a little confused because Al didn't say anything. He actually introduced us as Sacagawea, which was a kind of an inside joke about, you know, that previous year Aqueous had to turn down playing Modown Music Festival because of a radius clause on another festival, which is super common. But Al like was joking that he was going to get us on anyways by renaming us, which, you know, the Sacagawea thing is a reference to this throughway in Buffalo called the Skajakwita, and it was like pronounced wrong. It was something like that. I can't even remember exactly why he was calling us that, but he introduced us as that, and then we walk out, and like maybe half the crowd knew who we were, and others were confused. And so we did this like whole improv section on all their gear, you know, and then you know they came and replaced us, and it was like super cool. And I think actually one thing that I learned that was an amazing lesson as a guitar player was, so, you know, when I went up there, I used all of Chuck's gear, like his, you know, his guitar, his pedal board, his amp. And it's fascinating because when you're young and you're growing up, you assume that if you get a lot of the gear that one of your favorite guitarists uses, that you're going to sound exactly like them. And it's funny because literally, you know, you never have the opportunity to actually play for those people's gear like that. And I did, and it's funny because I didn't sound like Chuck. You know, I still sounded like me. And I thought that was like a cool, like, you know, like it made me kind of reflect in an interesting way that, like, you know, I thought that was a good lesson. Like, you just, you know, you're always you. It's in your hands and in your soul. Like, it's not necessarily the gear, but that was a cool one. And it was funny because it wasn't even necessarily like a sit in, it was like a swap out. But it was like super fun and really cool.
A full band sit in, some inside jokes, some Buffalo history tucked in there if you're paying close attention. That's a meaty night in Boston. And obviously you've been out there with Mo a few times since and forged that friendship on the road. It's so great to hear, Mike. Before I let you go, I kind of a more speculative question, because who are we if we can't have a little fun in speculation? I mean, you spent time on stage with so many bands. If you could sit in with any band, you know, past or present, we won't put restrictions or guardrails around it on any song. What's the first thing that comes to mind?
This is a really interesting one. And I thought about this because, man, there's so many different ways you can go with this. But I have to say, when I really thought about it, I would probably go with Pink Floyd, right? 1977, the album Animals came out, which is one of my favorite albums of all time. Super powerful. But it's interesting because that was one of the first ones where David Gilmour had brought in another guitarist, this guy named Snowy White. And there was a lot of like dual guitar leads, like these epic harmonies, you know, on these really crazy long songs off of Animals. So my dream would probably be to play with Pink Floyd in 1977, playing the song Dogs, which is like one of my favorites of all time. And if I could like harmonize with David Gilmour, that would be like, you know, that's like the ultimate impossible dream, you know? And then I kind of thought too, for one, if you know, I know I was supposed to just pick one, but I'm going to pick two, because I'm going to just, I had to. I thought like, if I was thinking on more of a modern level, like what, you know, what's possible now, I'm actually a huge fan of the band Lettuce. And they have this song on their album Crush called Trilogy, which is like right up my alley. It's like super, like, it's like got a really heavy pocket and it's like really groove based and kind of hip hoppy and trippy and spacey. But I just like love the feel of it. And Adam Deitch is one of my favorite drummers in the world. Shameen is a sick guitarist. And that song in particular would be like my modern dream sit in. I think that would be really fun.
To our friends in Lettuce, and hey, to our friends who are alumni of Pink Floyd, if you're listening, check out Mike. Make this happen.
Yeah, I'm available. Give me a call.
Mike, thank you so much. Great to hear from you.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me on.
That brings us to the end of episode 8. Many thanks to all of you out there for listening to the Jam Bass Podcast. Thanks also to Ross and Mike for being on this episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Jam Bass Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or wherever you access your favorite podcasts. If the Jam Bass Podcast isn't available on your preferred provider, or if you have any other questions, topics, or other ideas you'd like to hear us address on a future Jam Bass Podcast, please send an email letting us know at podcast@jambass.com. And as always, go see live music.